All right, we are back, and we hope that we are reassuring you out there in Radio Land who have been wondering whether we were giving up the ship. Obviously, we have not abandoned ship, though we do confess to having been quite discouraged by recent political events. Now, at one point, Miss Millen was observed grabbing a life jacket and going over the side, but we fished him back out. But to those of you who made direct inquiries, Linda, Dr. B, Toby, Elise, Nancy, Bo, to all of you, no, we're still here and still afloat. And looking ahead to the future, and especially for the benefit of you, Guy, who's manning the booth right now, we will continue to produce programs in the year 2025, we think. But we're pretty darn sure it won't be, you know, every week of the year. You KDVS listeners will no doubt be kept apprised of what's going on in the world via Planetary Radio, because you know, they do good work. And we did mention in 2024 that we would be reaching out to them to see if we could bring their host on this program and do what we can to blend the two, just as in the past we had their prior host, Matt Kaplan, on the show, I don't know, three or four times. So that's something else on the to-do list. Another matter on our to-do list was to get back to Greg Palast, who was going to look into the election and see if he could determine if things were on the up and up. We've not heard what Greg's findings are as yet, but we will keep our eyes peeled. In the meantime, I want to quote from him on his piece from a few days ago about the passing of America's 39th president, Jimmy Carter, who died at the age of 100 at his home in Plains, Georgia. But to quote briefly from what Greg had to say about Jimmy Carter, well, what he said was, "I couldn't stomach Jimmy Carter until my view of him turned around 180 degrees just 4 years ago. Like many Democrats who supported Ted Kennedy's run against him, I tagged Carter as just some grinning anti-New Deal Bible-thumping goober. And his post-presidential peacemaking was often dangerously naive, as I saw in Liberia, where Carter had boosted the presidential candidacy of war criminal Charles Taylor for president, because Taylor, a murderous monster, proclaimed he'd been born again in Jesus. I nicknamed Carter the Dangerous Christian. But then, while staking out the current governor of Georgia, the vote-suppressing racist Brian Kemp, I did a little recon outside Kemp's office. I had my face to the wall pretending to study the official portraits of the state's governors. I was struck that only one, James Earl Carter, refused to have his photo taken with his own state flag visible because it included the Confederate States' stars and bars. In Georgia at that time, in 1971, that took immeasurable courage. That took integrity. Alav HaShalom, President Carter." I have to confess that I, too, was not wild about Jimmy Carter when he was president, because I thought he was, well, the kind of thing the Republican Party actually became, which was a guy embedded with the fundamentalist Christians of these various hoo-ha southern churches and mega churches and all the born-agains. But Carter, it turns out, who was a Sunday school teacher for something like a couple of decades, wasn't exactly that kind of Christian, much to those people's disappointment, because they turned against him in droves in 1980 to elect Ronald Reagan as president. And of course, Reagan begat Bush Sr., and Bush Sr. begat Bush Jr., and led the way to, well, someone else. And we've mentioned the show before, when you take a look back at that that time period, the late 1970s, to recall that the nightly news would start out with, "This is day X of the Iranian hostage crisis," making it seem as though the fact that 40 people were being held and detained in Iran at the time was the most important story in the world. It did irreparable harm to Jimmy Carter and represents, well, I guess you could say malevolent forces at work, the same kind of forces that well, are still working overtime, but let's not go into that right now. I think what I'll do instead is talk about what Jimmy Carter had to say about what is surely, at this point in time, one of the hot potato issues in world politics, the question of what's going on over in the Middle East. As president, Jimmy Carter strove very hard to mitigate matters in Palestine/Israel and had a great deal of success. And in 2006, he revisited the topic as an ex-president, writing a book titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And because, sadly, a lot of what Jimmy Carter was writing about back then is still absolutely relevant today, I think it'd be worth our while to quote from what the former president had to say on this topic. Said Jimmy Carter in his summary chapter, "Since the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty was signed in 1979, that was Carter's work, much blood has been shed unnecessarily, and repeated efforts for a negotiated peace between Israel and her neighbors have failed. Despite his criticism from some Arab sources, this treaty stands as proof that diplomacy can bring lasting peace between ancient adversaries. Although disparities among them are often emphasized, the 1974 Israeli-Syrian withdrawal agreement, the 1978 Camp David Accords, the Reagan Statement of 1982, the 1993 Oslo Agreements, and the treaty between Israel and Jordan in 1994, and the Arab Peace Proposal of 2002, and Geneva Initiative and International Quartet's Roadmap all contain key common elements that can be consolidated if pursued in good faith." Said Carter, there are two interrelated obstacles to permanent peace in the Middle East. One, some Israelis believe they have the right to confiscate and colonize Palestinian land and try to justify the sustained subjugation and persecution of increasingly hopeless and aggravated Palestinians. And two, some Palestinians react by honoring suicide bombers as martyrs to be rewarded in heaven and consider the killing of Israelis as victories. In turn, Israel responds with retribution and oppression, and militant Palestinians refuse to recognize the legitimacy of Israel and vow to destroy the nation. The cycle of distrust and violence is sustained, and efforts for peace are frustrated. Casualties have been high as the occupying forces impose ever tighter controls. From September 2000 until March 2006, 3,982 Palestinians and 1,084 Israelis were killed in the Second Intifada. These numbers include many children. As indicated earlier, there was an ever-rising toll of dead and wounded from the latest outbreaks of violence in Gaza and Lebanon. The only rational response to this continuing tragedy is to revitalize the peace process through negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. But the United States has, in effect, abandoned this effort. It may be that one of these periodic escalations of violence will lead to strong influence being exerted from the international community to implement a roadmap for peace. These are the key requirements. A, the security of Israel must be guaranteed. The Arabs must acknowledge openly and specifically that Israel is a reality and has a right to exist in peace behind secure and recognized borders, with a firm Arab pledge to terminate any further acts of violence against the legally constituted nation. B, the international debate within Israel must be resolved in order to define Israel's permanent legal boundary. The unwavering official policy of the United States since Israel became a state has been that its borders must coincide with those prevailing from 1949 until 1967, unless modified by mutually agreeable land swaps, specified in the unanimously adopted UN Resolution 242, which mandates Israel withdrawal from occupied territories. This obligation was reconfirmed by Israelis leaders in agreements negotiated in 1978 at Camp David and in 1993 at Oslo, for which they received the Nobel Peace Prize. And both of these commitments were officially ratified by the Israeli government. Skipping ahead to number C among these requirements, the sovereignty of all Middle Eastern nations and sanctity of international borders must be honored. There's little doubt that accommodation with Palestinians can bring full Arab recognition of Israel and its right to live in peace, with an Arab commitment to restrain further violence initiated by extremists. Noted Carter, Israel's continued control and colonization of Palestinian land have been the primary obstacles to a comprehensive peace agreement in the Holy Land. In order to perpetuate the occupation, Israeli forces have deprived their unwilling subjects of basic human rights. No objective person would personally observe existing conditions in the West Bank and dispute these statements. Two other interrelated factors have contributed to the perpetuation of violence and regional upheaval. The condoning of Israeli actions from a submissive White House and U.S. Congress during recent years, and the deference with which other international leaders permit this unofficial U.S. policy in the Middle East to prevail. There are constant and vehement political and media debates in Israel concerning its policies in the West Bank. But because of powerful political, economic, and religious forces in the United States, Israeli government decisions are rarely questioned or condemned. Voices from Jerusalem dominate in our media, and most American citizens are unaware of circumstances in the occupied territories. At the same time, political leaders and news media in Europe are highly critical of Israel's policies. Americans were surprised and angered by an opinion poll published in 2003 of 7,500 citizens in 15 European nations, indicating that Israel was considered to be the top threat to world peace ahead of North Korea, Iran, or Afghanistan. The United States has used its UN Security Council veto more than 40 times to block resolutions critical of Israel. Some of these vetoes have brought international discredit to the United States, and there is little doubt that lack of a persistent effort to resolve the Palestinian issues is a major source of anti-American sentiment and terrorist activities throughout the Middle East and the Islamic world. It's pretty strong words. Skipping ahead a couple paragraphs. In order to achieve its goals, Israel has decided to avoid any peace negotiations and to escape even the mild restraints of the United States by taking unilateral action called convergence or realignment to carve out for itself the choice portions of the West Bank, leaving Palestinians destitute within a small and fragmented remnant of their own land. The holding of almost 10,000 Arab prisoners and the destructive military response to the capture of three Israeli soldiers have aroused global concern about the hair-trigger possibility of a regional war being launched. And finally, Carter notes near the end of the chapter that the bottom line is this: peace will come to Israel and the Middle East only when the Israeli government is willing to comply with international law, with the roadmap for peace, with official American policy, with the wishes of a majority of its own citizens, and honor its own previous commitments by accepting its legal borders. All Arab neighbors must pledge to honor Israel's rights to live in peace under these conditions. The United States is squandering international prestige and goodwill and intensifying global anti-American terrorism by unofficially condoning or abetting the Israeli confiscation and colonization of Palestinian territories. It will be a tragedy for the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the world if peace is rejected and a system of oppression, apartheid, and sustained violence is permitted to prevail. Pretty strong words from the ex-president written 18 years ago. And sad to note, they are still applicable today. Yeah, in Carter's view, worst-case scenario was yet another war starting, and another war has started. Now, admittedly, this was induced by an attack by Hamas from Gaza, across the border into Israeli territory. But we at Radio Parallax suspect that there's a lot more to the story. We think the fact that Israeli defense forces who were redeployed to the West Bank and not on the Gaza border just before the incident has something to do with what went down. And although that was, without a doubt, a deplorable act, when you take a look at what Israel's bombing has done to Gaza, it just takes your breath away. And there's surely a lot more we could say about that, and we could go a little dark on the topic, but, you know, we're not going to do that today. Happy New Year, and see if we can find some lighter fare for the remainder of this segment. All right. At the end of every year, the magazines, national magazines, will usually publish a list. And, of course, I guess I'm speaking to the older members of our audience because you younger members are pulling everything off the web. But no matter, wherever you get your news, you know that, you know, they take a look back, a long look back at what happened in the year before and cite the notable people who have left us. I certainly could go through that list of people, but I don't have the heart this year. Instead, I'm just going to mention two people that we lost in 2024. I mention them because both of them, in a way, made an appearance on the show. Well, not in a way. One of them made an appearance in a way. One of them was definitely one of our favorite interviews in the early era of doing this show. That would be NPR's Morning Edition host, Bob Edwards, who'd written a very good book about a legend of journalism, Edward R. Murrow. And after we had Bob Edwards on, this inspired us to reach out to some of the people who had worked for Ed Murrow. This included Daniel Shore, and Richard C. Hodelet. And believe you me, if you've never heard either of those interviews, we highly recommend you go to our archives at RadioParallax.com and pull them up. Dan Shore is probably well known to you, or at least most of you, from the great work he did at NPR at the end of his career. Richard C. Hodelet, maybe not so much, but I can tell you that Richard C. Hodelet was the first report that came back to America from the D-Day invasion in 1944. Yeah, do look those up, but before you do that, listen to the interview that we did with Bob Edwards. It's still one of my favorites after all these many years. I used to cite it as our 100th program, and it was about our 100th because the order may have gotten mixed up a little bit as things have been changed over the years. But anyway, it's easy to find, and we highly recommend it. The other obituary that I want to cite, and I didn't even know about this until a couple of days ago, was the passing of legendary SCTV comic Joe Flaherty. Now, it's fair to say that Flaherty has made an appearance on Radio Parallax because in our airing of one of our favorite National Lampoon Radio Hour bits, which was that of Perry Schreiner, court-appointed lawyer, which is frankly an all-star cast. We're talking Gilda Radner, Harold Ramis, John Belushi, and Joe Flaherty. Well, we consider that to be kind of a masterpiece of comedy, and I'm sure if you dig around on our website, you will also find that recording. I think we aired it more than once because we like it a lot. We did have an opportunity of sorts to get Joe Flaherty on this program some years back because it turned out one of our regular correspondents living in Los Angeles had Flaherty move into the same floor of the complex that he lived in. It might have been a bit of a stretch to reach out and try and obtain him, but we could have done it, and we probably should have tried. I do note that our correspondent went down to the dumpster in his apartment at one point and found a script apparently tossed out by Joe Flaherty for a return to television of SCTV. Now, if it wound up in the dumpster, I'm sure it was rejected by its author, or maybe it was a preliminary copy. I don't know. Our correspondent evidently snagged it out of the dumpster, but could not remember upon further inquiries whether he kept it or not, which frankly makes us want to, put a boot up his rear.
What was he doing in the dumpster?
That I don't know. In fairness, I don't think he was dumpster diving. But anyway, when I heard about the passing of Flaherty, I mentioned to my informant that, my God, I was just thinking about him the other day. He said, what? And I said, well, I was thinking of his character, Count Floyd, on the mythical network that these Canadian people put together. Anyway, Flaherty adopted the character of Count Floyd, who was the supposed host of Horror Chiller Monster Theater. He would come out with a fake Transylvanian accent and a Dracula cape and try to reassure his audience that this movie that it had, this one is really scary, kids. I remember two examples. One was, tonight's movie is Georgie Girl. Believe me, it's really scary. Then a week later it was, well, that wasn't so scary last week's movie, but this one is really going to terrify you. It is Four for Texas, starring the Rat Pack. That's very scary. Anyway, I'm not doing it justice, I can assure you. But anyway, if you've never checked out the work of the late, great Joe Flaherty, do yourself a favor and investigate. I mean, all those guys, Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hare, Rick Moranis, John Candy. I don't know, it was an all-star cast. They were every bit the equal of Saturday Night Live in its earliest incarnation and its best incarnation, frankly. That's about all I've got to say on that. I do think we should take at least one tumble into one of our perennial favorites, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. A good week a few weeks back for dealing with obesity, although I have some doubts about this story. It is alleged that a new study reported a drop in U.S. obesity levels for the first time in at least a decade. But here's the rub. They're citing the numbers of the average American BMI falling from 30.24 in 2022 to 30.21 in 2023. noted that the trend may be driven partly by better access to Ozempic and other GLP-1 weight loss drugs. Well, if we can't do better than a 0.03 drop in BMI, well, they need to keep working on this one. And let's face it, in 2025, Americans do need to work on their obesity problem, like with a little bit less food, a little bit more exercise, and, you know, GLP-1 is optional. Moving right along, it was a bad week recently for remote work, with the news that John McDougall, chairman of the Edmonton Police Commission, announced his immediate resignation. This supersedes his poorly received announcement of the prior week that he planned to leave Canada and serve out the remainder of his term until 2026 from Portugal. And it was an ugly week, you'd have to say, for reporting some weeks back, with the news that former Fox News host Tucker Carlson revealed in a new documentary that he was, quote, physically mauled by a demon while in bed 18 months prior. He said the assault left him bleeding from claw marks on his side. He said, "No one has to believe me, but that happened to me." Mr. McMillan? Yes, as Dave Barry might have said and did say, one of Vladimir Putin's useful idiots. And also a useful idiot of someone we're not going to mention. And also, it was a good week recently for, I guess you'd say, that motto, to serve and protect, with the news that an Ohio police officer has retracted his threat to stop helping citizens who vote Democratic. Yes, apparently Sheriff's Lieutenant John Rogers posted on social media that citizens must henceforth, quote, provide proof of who you voted for, unquote, and warned Democratic voters that I will not help you survive the end of days. Rogers blamed his posts on sleep medication, saying it does cause some of my communications to be out of character, which is a documented side effect. Yeah, well, maybe. You know what this calls for. And according to the Week magazine, it was a bad, which is where all these come from, I would like to add, it was a bad week recently for cheese lovers, with the news that 24 tons of rare cheddar, with an estimated worth of about $390,000, was stolen from a top London cheese store. Celebrity chef Jamie Oliver asked Brits to stay on the lookout for the loot, saying if they hear about posh cheese going for cheap, it's probably some wrong'uns. And finally, an item that is ugly, I'd have to say, for political correctness, but probably, on the other hand, good for the MAGA crowd and bad for common sense, is the news that Virginia's Loudoun County School District has apologized after a history teacher passed around a piece of raw cotton during a lesson on slavery. Southern states, of course, reliance upon African slaves to pick cotton for its textile industry is widely recognized as one cause. I'm quoting one cause. I would say the cause of the U.S. Civil War. But after complaints from local civil rights groups that letting students handle cotton was, quote, culturally insensitive, unquote, the district apologized and pledged, "We must and will do better." I happen to be scanning the radio dial and stumbled upon one of these crazy right-wing stations not long ago, and I heard them talking about this incident, which was just a field day for them. And, you know, you do have to pause and say, wait, a piece of cotton, culturally insensitive, requiring an apology? Whew. Again, Mr. McMillan. In the couple minutes we have left, I think I'm going to rely upon one of our old standbys, the Uncle John's Bathroom Reader Series. In this case, the 28th edition of this, and pull out three items under the headline of "I Divorce You." The Bathroom Reader Series noted that married couples get divorced for many reasons: lack of trust, finances, religious differences, and then there's some really odd reasons, like these. And I'm going to cite three. Reason: he didn't like Frozen. A broken-hearted Japanese man posted his story to the website The Gravesite of Married People in Japanese. He said that he and his wife had enjoyed a happy marriage without any strife or financial hardships until she saw the Disney movie Frozen. She liked it so much, she saw it again and again and again. And when she finally took him to see it, his response was, "It's okay." She angrily replied, "If you can't understand what makes this movie great, there's something wrong with you as a human being." She left him that day and later filed for divorce. And then we have a divorce on account of too much cake. The details are a 31-year-old Chinese man divorced his 27-year-old wife in 2009 because she made him eat cake with every meal. Egg cake, fruit cake, chocolate cake, the man told reporters. "I felt like a bakery dustbin." News reports added that the man said he actually liked having cake so often at first, but now the mere mention of the word cake makes him sick. And finally, reason for a divorce, too much mother-in-law. The details are an Italian couple identified only as Stefano and Mariana were married in Rome in December of 2010 and set off on a romantic 3-week honeymoon stay at a 5-star hotel in Paris. When they got to the airport, Mariana got a surprise. Without asking Mariana, Stefano had invited his mother to spend the honeymoon with them. Mariana filed for divorce less than a week after they returned home.
Mother-in-law.
And that about does it for the show. Once again, Happy New Year, the year in question being 2025. Let us hope it is a happy one. This program was produced by Edward McMillan, who, for the record, did not bring his mother along on his honeymoon.
Aww.
Thanks for your good work at KDVS, Guy. I'm Douglas Everett. Listen to Radio Parallax, and we'll see you again soon.
She was